has several more years in office. And of course, China is waiting to see who follows President Obama into the White House. But I don't think they're going to wait on some of the big issues they consider important, such as she pointed out, their protection of their so-called territorial rights in the South China Sea. And despite President Obama saying that China should abide by an international tribunal's ruling that invalidated their claims in the South China Sea, today Chinese ships were spotted near disputed waters of the Scarborough Shoal off the Philippines. So I think they're just going to keep on doing what they want.
Well, just again, briefly, President Obama heads to Laos for a conference of Asian nations. One of the things that's come up before that is Rodrigo Duterte, Philippines president, talking badly about the president.
Yes, that's right. And he threatened President Obama that he would curse at him if he brought up the subject of extrajudicial killings and his war on drugs. President Obama did not say whether he'd raise that issue. He just said he'd assess the situation and try to have the best conversation he could.
Thanks very much. That's NPR's Anthony Kuhn speaking to us from the G2 summit in China.
In this country, we have a glimpse of a U.S. Senate race. It's one of the contests that will decide control of the Senate this fall. And in this contest in New Hampshire, both candidates are trying the same tactic. Each is linking her rival to a presidential candidate with liabilities. It is a common story for Republicans to have an awkward relationship with Donald Trump. In New Hampshire, the Democrat has faced scrutiny for how she talks about Hillary Clinton. NPR's Elsa Chang reports.
On the edge of the White Mountains, if you're walking around a town called Littleton and suddenly seized by an uncontrollable urge to play music, sit yourself down at one of the sidewalk pianos on Main Street. That's where Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte stumbled on Chris Hall.
That was fantastic. Yeah, nice to meet you.
That was amazing.
Ayotte's taking a quick break from meeting with small business owners in town. But even during this momentary distraction, Hall asks the question she cannot escape.
So you're a Republican, I guess.
I'm a Republican.
Are you on the Trump bandwagon? Or?
Listen, I think this, this is a year where, as I look at the choices, I'm going to be voting for him, but I haven't endorsed him because I've had some very public disagreements with him on some of the things that he said.
It's a position Ayotte has had to repeat over and over again. She will not endorse Donald Trump, but she will vote for him. Her opponent, Democratic Governor Maggie Hassan, has mocked this response, saying Ayotte's trying to have it both ways. But Ayotte contends she's showing her independence from Trump. She's criticized him for his proposed ban on Muslims entering the U.S., his remarks about women, and his attacks on the family of a slain Muslim American soldier. And yet Ayotte is flipping the script on Hassan.
When has Governor Hassan ever stood up to Hillary Clinton?
New Hampshire is a state where about 40% of voters call themselves independent, and both candidates are trying to exploit the unpopularity of the other's presidential nominee. So while Hassan is knocking Ayotte for splitting the difference between supporting and endorsing Trump, Republicans keep referring to this CNN interview last month.
Do you think that she's honest and trustworthy?
I support Hillary Clinton for the presidency because her experience and her record demonstrate that she's qualified to hold the job.
Hassan was asked three times if Clinton was trustworthy, and she never said yes. She has since clarified that she does think Clinton is honest, but it's still awkward.
Do you think Clinton has a perception problem here among New Hampshire voters about her trustworthiness?
Well, what I focus on is, again, why I think she's the best person to be president of the United States, why she has the qualifications, the experience.
Clinton is leading Trump by an average of 9 points in New Hampshire. Meanwhile, Ayotte and Hassan are virtually tied, which means Ayotte is picking up voters who feel queasy about Trump. And right-leaning Rockingham County on the seacoast might be where that's happening. Scott Harvey can't bring himself to vote for Trump at the moment, but no such hesitation for Ayotte.
The Republican Party is more in line with my views, and I think Ayotte is more in line with the Republican Party than Trump is. Trump's more of a wild card.
But Mary Dempsey, who's an independent sitting down the beach from Harvey, won't be voting for Ayotte precisely because the senator's voting for Trump.
I just feel as though if you can stand behind him, if you can say, I'm going to make an effort to get him elected, then I question what your values are.
And Dempsey says for her, making a show of standing up to Trump once in a while doesn't redeem Ayotte. Elsa Chang, NPR News, Concord, New Hampshire.
On Saturday, NPR lost a dear member of our family, the writer, performer, and longtime NPR contributor, Verda Mae Smart Grosvenor.
She wrote vividly of her roots in South Carolina and explored culture through food. Here's how she did that on NPR in 1983 while talking of collard greens.
I was a collard patch child, but don't feel sorry for me. Those of us raised in the collard patch did very well, thank you. Collard greens, an ancient vegetable enjoyed by the Greeks and Romans, are full of minerals and vitamins. Pot liquor, as we call the liquid the greens are cooked in, is the only liquor good for you. Now, you'd think with a culinary heritage like that, everybody would adore collards. Not so. In our society, where almost everything, including foods, are seen as status symbols, collard greens are considered low-down vegetables. Many of us from the collard patch on the upward mobile trek leave the collard behind. Well, I don't cook collards because they stink up the house. I eat collards occasionally. They don't sell collards in our neighborhood. Well, I love collards. Fixing a pot of collard greens is a very satisfying experience. You have to handle each leaf personally, cleaning and cutting leaf unto leaf and green embrace. And then there is the smell of the greens cooking, full-bodied, deliberate, earthy. So I don't care if a legend ever wears a collard green or if I never see them in a commercial. I think collards are of wheat on vittles. There will always be a pot of greens cooking in my kitchen. Langston Hughes asks, in the quarter of the Negroes, in the pot behind the paper doors, in the old coal stove, what's cooking? What's smelling, Leotine? Lita, lovely Lita, and a leaf of collard green. Lovely Lita, Leotine. Lovely leaf of collard green.
And lovely Verda Mae grew up speaking Gullah Geechee. It's a dialect of English which developed among West African slaves along the Atlantic coast.
Her first cookbook memoir was called Vibration Cooking, or The Travel Notes of a Geechee Girl. For that and many other writings on African-American cuisine, she was presented with a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Southern Foodways Alliance.
She also won a James Beard Award among the many accolades she received for her storytelling. Verda Mae Smart Grosvenor died on Saturday of natural causes. She was 79 years old. This is NPR News.
It is 8:18 on this Labor Day morning. Thank you so much for starting your day with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Headlines are next, and you can hear about which issue some Democratic groups in Wisconsin are pushing within the U.S. Senate race. Hear more on that story in a couple of minutes.
WGTD is on your smartphone. For local news and the rest of the mobile version of our website, log on to WGTD.org. For live audio streams of WGTD, 24/7 Jazz HD2, and SportsWeb, visit the App Store and download the free WGTD app.
Rare blooper footage, live experiments, and more. WPR is proud to promote culinary events. For tickets, go to OvertureCenter.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Afghan officials say a pair of bombings in Kabul today left at least 24 people dead. Nearly 100 others were wounded. The explosions went off near the Afghan Defense Ministry and other government buildings. ISIS is claiming responsibility for today's series of car bombings in Syria. State media in Damascus put the death toll at 38. A human rights group puts that number higher. A replica of 17th-century London was set on fire last night along the Thames to commemorate the Great Fire 350 years ago that consumed much of the city. NPR's Frank Langford reports from London.
The model stretched for more than the length of a football field on a barge on the river, made for a spectacular sight as it burned. The Great Fire of London destroyed more than 13,000 homes, but also set the stage for the reconstruction of the modern British capital as we know it.
Some coastal flooding is possible today in the northeastern U.S. as Hermine continues moving farther out into the Atlantic. Meteorologist John Cangelosi is at the National Hurricane Center in Florida.
There are still tropical storm warnings in effect for Long Island and the southern portion of New England, including Connecticut, Rhode Island, and the southeast portion of Massachusetts.
Some beaches in the Northeast are closed on this Labor Day because of rough waves and strong riptides. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. Democratic groups in Wisconsin and other states with key U.S. Senate races are trying to make raising the minimum wage a pivotal campaign issue. The groups released a poll by a Democratic firm last week showing 63% of Wisconsin voters favor a $15 minimum wage. Peter Rickman with the Wisconsin Working Families Party says that when his group goes door-to-door to talk to potential voters, people want to talk about the minimum wage.
We talk to voters about pledging their vote on the basis of this general program of a fair economy, but we're leading and specifically calling out the $15 an hour minimum wage issue. And without fail, it's the most resonant thing that we bring up on the doors with people.
In Wisconsin's Senate race, Democrat Russ Feingold favors a $15 minimum wage. Republican Ron Johnson opposes it, arguing that such a move would decrease the number of jobs available to people looking to work their way up the economic ladder. An Edgerton police lieutenant who punched a hole in a wall during a family disagreement was arrested for domestic battery, lost 5 days' pay, but was not prosecuted and was reinstated instead. The Wisconsin State Journal reports that public records provide new tales on the case involving the department's second-highest-ranking officer, Lieutenant Randy Meehan. But the Dane County Sheriff's Department office declined to prosecute the case back in April, and Edgerton's police chief reinstated Meehan the same day.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Visit St. Pete Clearwater, offering 35 miles of white sand Florida beaches, and the Dalí Museum, presenting Farron Adria, The Invention of Food, September 25th through November 27th at visitstpeteclearwater.com. From Home Instead Senior Care, providing an individualized approach designed to meet a family's needs, offering a range of in-home care services from help around the house to Alzheimer's care to keep aging loved ones at home. HomeInstead.com/NPR. And from the National Education Association, NEA is committed to creating opportunity for all students, regardless of background or zip code, to experience the transformative power of a great education at greatpublicschools.nea.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Today in Your Health, a success story in the Battle of the Bulge.
First, we explore stem cell treatments. Hundreds of clinics in the United States are using them to treat medical conditions. The questions are whether stem cell treatments work and whether they work safely.
This week, the Food and Drug Administration will start considering how to regulate those clinics. NPR's Rob Stein reports.
If you search the web, you'll find clinics all over the country, like this one in Sunrise, Florida. They offer stem cell treatments for all sorts of health problems, from arthritic joints and torn tendons to spinal cord injuries, multiple sclerosis, and stroke.
At the U.S. Stem Cell Clinic, we're utilizing what are called adipose-derived stem cells, or fat-derived stem cells.
As this promotional video makes clear, these aren't human embryonic stem cells, which are controversial because embryos are destroyed to get them, and they're not the type of stem cells that scientists create in the lab.
These are considered autologous stem cells, which means you're utilizing stem cells from your own body.
And the clinic claims have amazing healing powers.
All of these cells have different growth factors and can help to promote healing.
And other clinics are using other kinds of stem cells, from bone marrow, blood, and even placentas. But there are big questions about all this.
There's a lot of sketchy stuff going on.
George Daly is a stem cell researcher at Harvard. He says stem cells are really promising and someday could revolutionize medicine by providing healthy cells and tissues for damaged parts of the body. But he says we're still years away from that.
You've got clinics springing up, taking a patient's own cells, and practitioners are then injecting these cells into arthritic joints, into spinal cords, into the brain, And there's really no evidence that this is going to work. And in fact, there are major concerns about safety.
The procedures could cause life-threatening infections. The cells could turn into tumors or trigger dangerous reactions by patients' immune systems. And these supposed treatments don't come cheap. Paul Knopfler is a stem cell scientist at the University of California, Davis. He estimates there are more than 500 of these clinics treating as many as 100,000 patients a year in the United States.
We're talking about really big bucks here. The therapies can run anywhere from $5,000 to $100,000 a shot.
And they're not covered by insurance. Knopfler thinks the Food and Drug Administration should crack down on these clinics.
The FDA needs to step up its game on this, because otherwise this could continue to grow as an industry, and it's just going to put more and more people at risk.
For their part, the stem cell clinics defend what they're doing. Kristen Camella is the chief scientific officer at the Florida clinic we heard about at the beginning of the story. She says they're helping a lot of sick people.
Patients should have access to their own body tissue, in particular for diseases where they have not had much success with traditional medicine. And if they are able to provide and give informed consent to move forward with these treatments, that is their right.
Camella acknowledges that two of her clinic's patients suffered detached retinas when they had stem cells injected into their eyes. So the clinic has stopped treating eye conditions. But otherwise, Camella says, they've had no serious problems.
There are always risks, no matter what you're doing. Now, that being said, our group has treated more than 6,000 cases, and we've had very few safety events associated with these treatments.
The FDA's first hearing about how best to regulate these stem cell clinics is scheduled for Thursday, followed by another two-day hearing next week. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Now to a procedure that has proved extremely effective in helping severely obese patients lose weight and keep it off. NPR's Patty Naiman reports on the latest research on gastric bypass surgery.
It really hit Terry White 8 years ago when he was at the mall with his wife.
And I was sitting down every few minutes to catch my breath.
He knew he had to lose weight for good.
Oh, I've lost 1,000 pounds probably over the years.
Dieting, losing, gaining back, and then some.
And that's how I got to be 378 pounds.
378 pounds at just 5'6". White decided to have surgery to reduce his stomach to about the size of an egg and restructure his intestines to absorb fewer calories and fat from food. The weight just fell off, he says. He didn't feel deprived. He just didn't want to eat that much. In 7 months, he'd lost 200 pounds. That was 8 years ago. He's gained back a bit, but not much.
Right now, I'm from 205 to 210, and it varies 2 or 3, 4 pounds one way or the other.
It turns out White's success isn't unique. In one of the largest and longest studies of bariatric surgery, researchers with the Durham Veterans Affairs Medical Center in North Carolina tracked the progress of nearly 1,800 veterans who underwent gastric bypass surgery. Researcher David Arterburn says they expected to see gradual weight gain over 10 years, with some patients even gaining back everything they lost. But that's not what they found.
Patients actually plateaued, and they maintained their weight loss and even lost a little bit more weight over the long term.
1 year after surgery, patients lost on average 98 pounds. 10 years later, they gained back on average only about 7 pounds. Arterburn says the surgery likely interferes with the body's natural defense to less food, a slowdown in metabolism. That's what dooms so many dieters. Arterburn says bariatric surgery seems to change how the brain perceives hunger.
Even though they're taking in a whole lot less calories than they were before, they don't feel like a constant urge to eat. And it's not just a reduction in the size of the stomach, they don't feel hungry in between meals.
This is exactly what happened to Terry White. He no longer feels hungry all the time, and he walks and jogs about 5 miles a day.
Before the surgery, all the thing I wanted to do was sleep, because every time I'd sit down, I'd go to sleep and snore. Lord knows I could snore.
It's been an unreal change, he says, in his quality of life. Patty Naiman, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
The constant innovation in Silicon Valley has not boosted the productivity of U.S. workers much in the last decade. In fact, over the last 12 months, productivity actually fell.
If this doesn't change, our standard of living is going to barely grow over the next 30 years. That's a horrible prospect.
On this Labor Day holiday, why we're laboring less efficiently. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Catch All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 today here on Wisconsin Public Radio or listen online at WPR.org. Good morning. It is 8:30 on this Labor Day, and you're listening to Morning Edition on WPR. I'm Maureen McCollum. The Milwaukee Veterans Affairs Medical Center says an email breach exposed information of about 21 veterans in the center's care. The center said in a news release and a letter to the veterans that someone hacked into a Wisconsin Medical College employee's email and obtained the veterans' health and personal information. The center shares information with the medical college as an academic affiliate. The letter said the breach was caused by the employee's improper account management. The employee's management team was alerted so they could take what the letter called appropriate personnel action. The news release says none of the veterans have reported any suspicious activity stemming from the breach. Health officials say a dead crow in southern Wisconsin has tested positive for the West Nile virus. The Janesville Gazette reports the crow was found in Rock County. The County Public Health Department says it's the first bird found infected in the county since surveillance for the mosquito-transmitted virus began in May. Health Officer Marie Noel Sandoval says the discovery means county residents need to take more precautions to prevent mosquito bites. Those include using mosquito repellent, disposing of tin cans, discarded tires and other items that hold water, and changing the water in bird baths and pet dishes. Mosquitoes get the virus by feeding on dead birds and can spread to humans through bites. Symptoms include fever, headache, muscle ache, rash, and fatigue. This is WPR News.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Mead Witter Foundation of Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin, supporting the activities of the citizens of central and northern Wisconsin, and encouraging your support of Wisconsin Public Radio programming.
Support comes from the Bristol Renaissance Fair. Eat, drink, and be merry. Succulent treats, sinful sweets, dashing and clashing nights, music and laughter. The Bristol Renaissance Fair is open weekends through Labor Day, located just west of I-94 near the state line.
Showers and thunderstorms are moving through northwest Wisconsin this morning, and there's a chance they could continue into the afternoon. Highs will be in the lower to mid-80s today and tonight. Showers and thunderstorms likely in the northwest still, with lows dropping down to near 70 degrees. Tomorrow, those showers and thunderstorms are likely across Wisconsin, with highs back up to the mid to upper 80s.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, working to crack the cancer code by identifying cancer mutations and mechanisms to help develop more effective therapies. Videos and white papers are available at discovercarebelieve.org. From Cigna, a global health service company dedicated to helping people improve their health, well-being, and sense of security. More information is available at cigna.com. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at rwjf.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. On this Labor Day, we may have evidence that complicates our picture of the American middle class. We've heard throughout this year's presidential campaign of stagnant wages and struggle. It is a decades-long trend. But some numbers suggest the picture may at last be improving. They are numbers suggesting the middle class finally got a meaningful raise last year. David Wessel is with us once again. He's director of the Hutchins Center at the Brookings Institution and a contributing correspondent to the Wall Street Journal. Hi, David.
Good morning.
What's the evidence?
Well, we'll get some official Census Bureau numbers next week, but there are a couple of census veterans at a small firm called Centier Research that keep track of this on a month-to-month basis. And they say that, adjusted for inflation, household income at the statistical middle of the middle class may have risen more in 2015 than any single year in more than a decade. Their data suggests that in June 2016, the median household income was about $57,200, and that's 2.5% higher, adjusted for inflation, than it was a year earlier.
Okay, so not exactly going to go out and spend wildly on a party with that 2.5% raise, but it's a raise.
Correct.
And what's driving it?
Well, I think that one thing's gone on is that many more people have jobs. In the past couple of years, the economy's added more than 5 million jobs. That obviously boosts the incomes of households. Average wages have begun to rise a little bit, although much less than one would have expected given how low the unemployment rate is. But I think it's important to remember that these numbers are adjusted for inflation. So when inflation is low, when the prices of food and energy fall, as they have been lately, that boosts the economist's measure of household income just as much as a raise does. But people don't often look at it that way.
They just see that they don't have much more money than they used to have.
Correct. And there's another thing that's really important to remember. Even after this recent rebound, the income of the typical American household today is lower than it was in the year 2000, 16 years ago. So things are getting better, but we're still not back to where we were before the recession, let alone back to where we were in the year 2000.
Which explains part of the frustration here, doesn't it, the long-term nature of this problem. And let me ask about another aspect of this, David. We're talking here about income, how much you make in a month or a year. What about household wealth, which crashed so much during the recession as people's home values went down and they lost retirement accounts and other things?
Right. So what we know from the big picture is that household wealth for all households together has gone up, and it's back close to where it was before the recession. House prices are rising again, and people who have money in the stock or bond markets have done pretty well. But that doesn't mean that people in the middle are doing well, because much of the increase in wealth we've seen has gone to the people at the very top.
What are Americans, particularly in that middle of the middle, saying about their financial situation? What are they feeling about it?
It's interesting. Public opinion polls show people are feeling a little better about the economy, but many of them still think the country is on the wrong track, which suggests to me that it's something other than the economy that is making people so anxious.
Something other than. David, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That's David Wessel of the Brookings Institution.
We're going to hear now how the TV network Telemundo went from not successful to the most watched Spanish language network in the U.S. Here's what it took. Primetime programs starring anti-heroes, villains with depth who are sympathetic. It was a big change from the cardboard cutout villains of the standard telenovelas or soap operas, which had come before. For NPR's Planet Money, Jasmine Garst went to Miami to find out how it worked.
That's the theme song to a telenovela I grew up on. It's called Marimar.
Marimar.
It's a classic storyline. Poor girl with a heart of gold.
No, abuelos. No me pregunten.
Meets wealthy, impossibly handsome man.
Su amante. Sí, su amante.
He shuns her at first, but viewers knew how this was going to end. In the U.S., Marimar was broadcast on Univision, the long-standing king of Hispanic media. Their formula was simple: rebroadcast telenovelas, mostly from Mexico. Telemundo, on the other hand, went from one financial crisis to the next. They went bankrupt in the 90s, and they were acquired by NBC. And for decades, their programming was uneven. Then, in 2011, they produced La Reina del Sur, the Queen of the South.
Voy a cantar un corrido.
It's the story of Teresa Mendoza, a poor Mexican girl who falls in love with a drug runner. But he gets killed in the very first episode. And she gets raped by his rival. Teresa Mendoza spends the rest of the telenovela avenging him and becoming one of the world's most powerful drug lords. She was like no female protagonist the genre had ever seen. Perla Farias was, at the time, the VP for telenovela development.
She killed people. She was a lesbian in the character. I mean, imagine coming from our telenovelas, our classical telenovelas. It was a big risk.
Telemundo spent more money than they had ever before. They hired Mexican actress Kate del Castillo, who is gorgeous, but not in the soft, misty-eyed way of so many telenovela heroines. She plays the role with a fierceness that would make Tony Soprano cower. Like in this clip, where she's giving orders to her foot soldiers.
El operativo va a ser hoy a medianoche. Muy bien.
The operation is going to be tonight at midnight, she commands. With 2.4 million viewers, La Reina del Sur broke Telemundo's records for a premiere. By the second month, it was beating Univision and English-language stations in major markets. Farias says the success shows that Spanish-speaking audiences were ready to embrace more complex characters.
They are villains, but they're not absolutely villains. They're humans.
In other words, they're anti-heroes. Nowadays, Telemundo's winning primetime is a lot of anti-heroes. El Señor de los Cielos is a show about a poor man's rise to drug lord, and Señora Acero is about a woman who works as a human smuggler on the U.S.-Mexico border. Luis Silverwasser is the president of Telemundo. He says the network is catering to a young Latino audience that is completely bicultural.
They're living in this country. They're living in the United States, so they may watch Telemundo, they may watch other Spanish channels, but they're also influenced by what's happening in English language television.
It's just common sense, he says. Why wouldn't a Spanish language network give its audience what other networks succeeded with? Jasmine Garst, NPR News, Miami. Voy a cantar
un corrido. Support for Planet Money comes from Squarespace, providing tools to help people turn their passions into a business with a customizable e-commerce website. Learn more at squarespace.com/NPR.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 8:41 on this Labor Day. Hope you're enjoying the day. Thanks for starting it with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Headlines are next, and in 10 minutes on Morning Edition, Renee Montaigne talks to a linguist who emphasizes that words, their meanings, and the way we use them change all the time. Hear more on that interview in 10 minutes on Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you've never given before, but you look forward to listening to WPR every day, that's a sign it's time to donate. It means that WPR is important to you, and you are important to us. We're listener-supported radio, which means we count on money from people like you to make the programs possible. Make your first ever contribution today at WPR.org. Thank you.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, says he will not discuss the killings of drug suspects in his country with President Obama when the two are in Laos this week. President Obama was asked about that today as the G20 summit wrapped up in China.
We will always assert the need to have due process and to engage in that fight against drugs in a way that's consistent with basic international norms. And so, undoubtedly, if and when we have a meeting, that this is something that's going to be brought up.
About 2,400 people have been killed in the Philippines since Duterte took office 2 months ago and began going after drug suspects. Hillary Clinton and her surrogates are campaigning in several states on this Labor Day, including Ohio and Pennsylvania. NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
This is the first time this campaign that Hillary Clinton is traveling on the same plane as her press corps. Now, this is actually something that's pretty traditional and typically starts earlier in the election cycle. But this election cycle has been anything but typical. And Donald Trump does not yet travel on the same plane as his press corps.
Trump is campaigning in Ohio today. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. A $640 million bridge project spanning the St. Croix River in western Wisconsin is a year behind schedule, and contractors don't know how much the delay will cost Wisconsin and Minnesota. The St. Croix River crossing will link Highway 64 in St. Croix County with the Twin Cities region. Michael Bears of the Minnesota Department of Transportation says bad weather, equipment breakdowns, and a shortage of construction workers has set them back.
Some of those challenges took a little longer than what everyone thought they would. And along with that, the workforce that we weren't able to get a strong night shift in the first year like we'd hoped. This year, that's gone much better. Progress has really recovered this year.
The St. Croix River crossing is now expected to open sometime next fall. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett says the city plans to hire more officers and give police more money after a deadly month. Barrett says the police department budget will be significantly larger than this year's budget. He also says the city will be funding multiple classes of new officers. Barrett says the final numbers are not known yet, since his administration is still working on next year's budget. Milwaukee recorded 24 homicides in August, the highest monthly total since July of 1991, when the victims of serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer were discovered. Barrett told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel the city's Office of Violence Prevention is expected to launch a new initiative within the next month. This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Stitch Fix, an online personal styling service where hand-selected clothing is delivered to the customer's home. Customers can keep what they love and send back the rest. Learn more at stitchfix.com. From TIAA, whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Some people are adjusting to life after coal. Their industry was wrecked, as we've been reporting, losing business to cheap natural gas and challenged by new environmental rules. Some of the toughest times are felt by workers in eastern Kentucky. In that mountain region, famous for coal, some areas lost their very last working mines. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports on the effort to rebuild.
In Hazard, Kentucky, a group of men slowly make their way up some telephone poles in the summer heat, using metal clips to grip the wood. As part of a program co-sponsored by the local community college, these men are learning to be telephone linemen. Most of them were, until recently, longtime coal miners, people such as Gabriel Smith.
I loved it when I was in the coal mines. I'm a third generation. I've done it my whole life. But I have a wife, I have two children, I have a third baby on the way, actually is due in 1 month. And this is my way of trying to get back on my feet.
A lot of these men already have job offers, though they may have to work a few hours away and come home on weekends. In 2011, 14,000 coal miners worked in eastern Kentucky. Today it's fewer than 4,000. These well-paying jobs helped fuel the entire economy, and their loss has been a real blow. Jeff Whitehead heads the Eastern Kentucky Concentrated Employment Program.
We've got counties that lost 40, 50% of their workforce. When that happened, we knew things were going to get bad, and we probably are braced for things to still get worse before they get better.
Many people already have fled the area in search of work. Betsy Clemens of the local Chamber of Commerce says that in a close-knit region where families go back generations, the out-migration has taken a toll.
In the mountains, you depend upon your family, like for child care and just any kind of needs. Someone gets sick or you have your family here to support you. And it's been devastating for those that have had to leave because they don't have that family support that they've always been used to.
If there's a bright side to the troubles here, it's that many people are beginning to think about what the post-coal world will look like and how to make eastern Kentucky more competitive to employers. There have been some efforts at subsidized retraining, such as the Lineman Program, and a push to bring better broadband to the region. Joel Brashear is with the Hyden Citizens Bank.
We're all worried that coal is gone. You know, I don't know for sure if coal will ever come back. Everybody hopes that it does, but we have to find other opportunities and other places for employment. And if we don't, we're going to have some serious issues.
Unlike some people here, Brashear doesn't believe in trying to lure manufacturers to the area. Too often, he says, factories come and go, and when they leave, small towns are devastated. He wants to see an effort to encourage entrepreneurialism, showing people how to start businesses that will stay in the area. There's already an effort to teach computer coding to ex-miners. Loretta Mester, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, who toured Hazard last week, says local leaders know what they're up against.
They understand that it takes leadership. They understand that it takes collaboration. They understand that you have to know what the jobs in demand in the future are going to be so that you can start now to train people in those jobs.
They also know they have to somehow stop the loss of people from the area. Because when a region's population shrinks, it makes rebuilding the economy that much harder. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's
It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock on this Labor Day. Thanks for listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. The music starts in 15 minutes, and today's highlights include a couple of pieces in honor of Labor Day, plus a symphony by Haydn and some keyboard music by Bach. Join Stephanie Elkins for Morning Classics just after the 9 o'clock news headlines. And stay tuned. Morning Edition continues next here on WPR.
Support for classical music comes from Piasecki Althaus Grief Share, a 13-week support group for adults grieving loss. Sessions held Wednesdays, August 3rd through October 26th at 5:30. Registration $20. You're invited to call 658-4101.
Artists, dancers, aerialists, instrumentalists, magicians, poets, and so much more. WPR is pleased to celebrate events that support the community. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
Showers and thunderstorms are clearing up in northwest Wisconsin, but there's a chance they could return by the afternoon. Highs will be in the lower to mid-80s, and tonight, showers and thunderstorms likely in the northwest with lows near 70 degrees, and tomorrow, showers likely across Wisconsin.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio is provided by the Lee Esther News Fellowship, providing early career journalists the opportunity to learn hands-on reporting, editing, and broadcasting in a professional setting as part of the WPR News Department.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Hawthorne Hollow is hosting its annual Walk in the Woods Art Fair on Saturday, September 3rd from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Over 60 artists will be featured, including live music, entertainers, and a kids' nature play station. Visit hawthornhollow.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. This Labor Day weekend at the beach or maybe a barbecue, you could easily hear something like this.
It's so hot out, I could literally die.
Or...
that is literally the cutest dog ever.
Okay, no one was actually dying, and that surely wasn't really the cutest dog ever, though our next guest argues that the meaning of that word literally, along with many others, is evolving, and that's okay with him. John McWhorter is a popular linguist and professor at Columbia University. His new book is called Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still Literally. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Renee.
Let's start with one of the words in that subtitle of your book, literally. Can you give us a thumbnail of how its usage came to change dramatically over the centuries?
Well, originally, literally meant by the letter. And we kind of like the idea that that's what it would always be used to mean. But over time, instead of meaning by the letter, what people really just meant was really. And so now literally doesn't have that by the letter meaning. It's something that people use to figuratively reinforce. So that means that we have this word that you can say means both one thing and then its opposite. And that seems to really get up people's nose. And I can understand how that can seem frustrating because it seems unusual. But the thing is, it isn't. It's something called a contronym. And so, for example, you can seed a watermelon, and everybody knows that that does not mean that you are laboriously putting the seeds into it. You're taking them out. But then you can seed something by putting a seed in the ground and watching something green come up. Contronyms, let's face it, are neat. We should rejoice that our language has interesting little wrinkles as long as they don't interfere with comprehension.
But the interesting part of many of these words, and this one in particular, is that they go back, some of them, so far. This use of literally, you write, goes back to a 1769 novel, The History of Emily Montagu. And I really must read the quote. "He is a fortunate man to be introduced to such a party of fine women at his arrival. It is literally to feed among the lilies." I mean, it's perfect. It's 1769.
It is, and he's not going to consume them. And yet we read that and we think, oh, how fancy, how fine. But then if we see somebody chewing gum and walking down the street today and using it in the same way, we think, goodness gracious, youth today, everybody's dumb. There's an inconsistency there. And it's based on a very understandable sense that language is supposed to stay the same, except there'll be new words for new things. You have to call a fax machine something. And then maybe some words will come in from other languages, such as sushi. And then there'll be slang. But it's less obvious that the very meanings of words and how we put them together are always ooching along such that the language we speak now is on its way to becoming another language.
What would be one of your examples of a word that morphed over the years to something quite different?
This is one of the best ones, silly. Silly starts out meaning blessed, but all of these implications happen to the word over time. If you're blessed, then one could assume that you're probably innocent, so it starts to mean innocent. But if you're innocent, then you could be seen as possibly a little naive, as kind of weak. Well, if you're kind of weak, and there comes a point when that's the main meaning of it, it could be that you have a weak mind. If you're weak-minded, then you might be a bit of a boob. And so next thing you know, silly has come from meaning something where you have an amen chord to being soupy sales.
You also cite the word adorable. At one point in the book, you say, what would you think if I said, I find the movies Citizen Kane and Taxi Driver adorable? And of course,
right.
We'd all say, really?
That makes no sense. And yet adore is a term that we could use. Oh, I adore Citizen Kane. But never would you say, what an adorable movie. Because adorable connotes something probably small or something dear in a way that you feel from above. That's the way adorable happens to have drifted. It's a lot of why Shakespearean language can be so difficult to understand when delivered live. Because a lot of those words are words we're completely familiar with, but it doesn't seem to quite make sense often because they're using the words at a different stage of the ooching than they happen to be in our time.
Right. It's not just words that we might not recognize because they've gone out of style altogether. They've
right.
been
it's
lost altogether. It's words we see and know the word, mm-hmm. but don't understand because it doesn't seem to mean the right thing.
Yeah. Somebody will say wit. And it means knowledge. It doesn't mean Noel Coward and champagne. And so we're hearing it differently. Or somebody will say generous, and you're thinking, well, what does magnanimity have to do with what this person is saying? There's a speech that Edmund does in King Lear that I'm thinking of with this. And really, it's not that he's saying that he's generous, it's he's saying that he's noble. That's what the word originally meant. Now, if you're a noble, one aspect of it might be that you are generous with your goods, that you give things to the public. After a while, generous came to mean magnanimous, and we use noble to mean what Shakespeare could use generous to mean. If we could go back to Elizabethan streets, we would be able to get around, but we'd have a headache. People would have a hard time completely getting us, and we would have a hard time completely getting them.
Well, you are very generous, I might say, about the use of language. But surely there are words that even irritate you.
Oh, hell yeah. Oh. Definitely. I'm very generous about it because I know that there's no scientific reason to despise how somebody is saying something. And I've got one, actually, that comes to mind most often that I'm sure makes me sound like quite the pill. I don't like it when people say in stores, can I get a Coke? Can I get a ham sandwich? I'm always saying, no, you cannot get it. There's just something that strikes me as a little short, slightly vulgar about that way of putting it. So yeah, I'm human. I get it. You cannot like the way people are saying things and yet understand that what they're saying isn't wrong. That's a kind of a karate kiddish maneuver that I think linguists end up putting themselves through. And I think that a lot of other people could do it too, and we'd feel better about what we hear around us.
John McWhorter, it has been quite literally a pleasure to speak with you.
Renee, thank you for having me on about this. I appreciate it.
And John McWhorter's new book is called Words on the Move.
Say the word, you'll be free.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Really? I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
And you can hear Morning Edition from 5 until 9 every weekday here on WPR, or listen on demand to that and many of our programs with the free WPR app. And there's news throughout the morning with hourly headlines and stories to read and listen to and comment on at WPR.org.
Support for WPR comes from the UW Health Breast Center, where all biopsies are reviewed by a team of cancer pathologists to determine an appropriate treatment plan. In healthcare, experience matters. UWHealth.org/secondopinion.
WGTD is on your smartphone. For local news and the rest of the mobile version of our website, log on to WGTD.org. For live audio streams of WGTD, 24/7 Jazz HD2, and SportsWeb, visit the App Store and download the free WGTD app. You're listening to WGTD HD,